From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll find out about a new traveling exhibit that hopes to get people talking about an issue that most of us don't want to talk about. That's child abuse. The Lisa Project is in Fresno this month. We'll talk with its creator in a little bit. We'll also find out about the four Malayan tiger cubs that are literally the talk of the town at Fresno's Chaffee Zoo. We'll find out how they're growing up, what their existence means for the survival of their species, and we'll talk about their father, Paca, who died yesterday at the zoo. We'll also go behind the scenes of the North American tour of Wicked, which is currently in Central California performing at the William Saroyan Theater. But first, we turn to another angle on the biggest story of 2014, California's drought. It's already causing state and federal fish agencies to take extraordinary steps to save fish. Late last month, the agencies began to truck 30 million fall-run Chinook salmon from hatcheries to release sites close to the ocean. As Amy Quinton reports, fish biologists say it's the best chance for their survival.
A semi-truck filled with juvenile salmon from the Coleman National Fish Hatchery is backing up to a pipe. Thousands of fish are then shot through the pipe into three large net pens in the Sacramento River in Rio Vista. This is the beginning of what state and federal fish agencies are calling a Herculean effort to save fall-run Chinook salmon. Over the next 22 days, 12 million fish will be released here instead of swimming 270 miles down the Sacramento River to the ocean where they will feed for 3 years. Stafford Lair with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife says the state also plans to truck and release almost 19 million salmon.
This operation is huge. We're talking 240 semi-tanker trucks that will be working over the next 2.5 months. Just the collaborative effort with Coleman is about almost $400,000 in terms of state costs.
The cost of not trucking the fish could be much higher. These are hatchery salmon that support not only recreational fishing, but an entire commercial fishing industry. John McManus with the Golden Gate Salmon Association says salmon fishing provides tens of thousands of jobs and has more than a $1.4 billion impact on the state's economy.
If we didn't truck these fish under these drought conditions, we believe we'd likely lose them all. It means the difference between being closed down like we were in 2008 and 2009 with no ocean salmon fishing versus what may turn out to be a decent year.
The drought forces salmon to contend with high river temperatures, low flows, and greater exposure to predators. Delta cross-channel gates that prevent them from getting killed in pumps at the state and federal water projects have had to remain open during the drought.
Juvenile salmon get sucked into the Delta cross-channel. They never come out. It's essentially a black hole.
McManus and his group have pushed state and federal agencies hard to make the decision to transport the fish. It's not something fish agencies necessarily like to do. In normal years, fish are released in the waters where they were hatched. They know to return there to spawn. Bob Clark with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says trucked fish may be confused.
The issue for us is when they return 3 years from now, because they haven't made the migratory path, they'll stray to other parts in the delta and we won't get as many fish back to the hatchery.
The transportation itself can stress fish, confuse them, and make them susceptible to predation. But biologists say transporting the salmon this year gives them a much better chance of survival. Howard Brown is with the National Marine Fisheries Service.
The potential adverse effects associated with trucking, I don't think, are outweighed by the risks of losing an entire year class of fish production.
Fish agencies keep the salmon in net pens to adjust to the change and prevent predators from attacking. They'll then be released by boat further down the channel. Trucking will help fall-run Chinook, but fish biologists remain concerned about the drought's effect on wild spring and winter-run salmon. They'll have to migrate on their own, and biologists fear many won't make it. In Sacramento, I'm Amy Quinton.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Fish agencies, farmers, and cities are all paying close attention to California's drought. But it's not just this year. After all, most of the rainy season is already over in Central California. But what about next year? People are already looking forward to 2015 and the possibility that it might be a wetter year. Joining us now to talk more about the long-term outlook and how El Nino factors into the story is the Fresno Bee's award-winning environmental reporter Mark Grossi. He recently wrote a piece looking back at El Nino and what it means for Central California in past years. Mark, welcome to Valley Edition.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
I'm doing great. And this is a very interesting thing because a lot of people are really excited talking about this warming of ocean waters in the Pacific that can sometimes mean a wet season for California, but that's not always the case. Why are people so excited about this possibility of an El Nino for 2015?
Well, I think there are more and more scientific reports and more data showing that the water really is warming up, and it takes 3 months for an average set of data to show whether the equatorial Pacific is warming up, and I think we're on the verge of that. So that's really welcome news in this dry year.
But it doesn't always necessarily translate to wetter conditions. Is that the case?
That is quite true, and there have been El Niños in the past 12 years that have been basically duds. So, and there have been, you know, La Niñas, which is the cool water flip side of it, that have been absolutely amazing. So, it's what it is it lets you hedge your bet a little bit, and that's the best part, you know.
And with a big drought like this, it's not just a one-year event. We are obviously feeling the cumulative effects of past dry years. And next year, water users, whether they're farmers or environmental agencies or cities, are going to be dealing with the effects of this year's lack of rainfall. Are water users maybe factoring that in, that possibility of next year being a wet year, into their actions this year?
No, it might be factoring into their prayers, but I don't think it has anything to do with their plans right now. If you're a farmer or if you're a city and you rely on river water, you're doing everything you can to find other ways to buy water at a water bank, to make deals with your neighbors, to do whatever you can do to make sure you can get through the unthinkable, which would be another dry year. Anything close to this would be really, really scary.
Yeah, I know the folks at the Turlock Irrigation District are actually taking their water supplies down to zero this year in the reservoir that they control, with the hopes that next year might have some respite from this dry conditions. When was the last time we had an El Nino?
It's been a few years now. I think it was 2009 and 10 was the last time, and it was not a very. It was a kind of a moderate El Nino, and it really didn't give us as much of a snowpack as you would expect from a phenomenon that has that kind of a reputation. So, you know, and when I say moderate, I mean it goes in degrees of temperature. The warmer it is, the bigger it is. And the discussion now is that they're hoping for a monster El Nino, which we haven't had in California since the late 1990s. And those are almost always really, really wet. So that's what's got people excited.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, we're talking with Mark Grossi of the Fresno Bee about the future for California's water year as the water year comes to a close here in a few months. And then we begin the 2015 season, obviously dealing with this drought. You wrote another interesting piece about a week ago talking about the deficit that we're in. And it's not just the lack of rainfall. We haven't had fog. We've had so much evaporation. Steve Johnson, who's a great meteorologist, was talking about this on our program a few months ago as well, that we have lost so much moisture, we really have a big hole, not just the lack of snowpack, correct?
Yeah. Well, it's kind of weird to see evapotranspiration actually taking place on a fairly large scale in the wintertime. It just doesn't happen around here. We usually have enough overcast and fog to to block that out, but that is not what happened this year, according to Steve and all the numbers that I've seen.
Have you seen anything like this? You've been covering environmental and water issues in California for years. Does this year ring any bells? People are talking about 1988 as one of the other very low snowpack years. Of course, the 1976-77 year. Does this year remind you of anything?
Yeah, it does remind me a lot of the 76-77 year. I was down in Bakersfield at that point, but you know the big difference here is that the environmental issues, the biological opinions for endangered fish up at the Sacramento San Joaquin River Delta, they're controlling a lot more of the water. We're more conscious of water quality and wildlife now than we were back then. So, you know, it hit hard then, but it was nothing like it is today. I mean, that's the big difference.
Yeah, again, Mark Grassi from the Fresno Bee with us today talking about El Nino. And are we in a La Nina right now? Is it a binary system? Either you're in one or you're in the other, or is there some middle ground, and is that where we're at right now?
I sort of call this La Nada. We're between the two. The ocean is neutral. And you know, we're talking about a huge swath of ocean along the equatorial Pacific stretching to the east. And they didn't notice this. Lots of fishermen maybe knew about this because the anchovy fishing was a little bit different. But scientists really didn't get hooked into this until just a couple of decades ago. And so, no, it's not either or. It's sometimes a flavor right in the middle.
In talking with a lot of people about this drought, one of the things that always comes up is climate change and how climate change can make drought situations like this more severe. Are we learning more about that issue as it plays out before our eyes? What are you hearing from the scientists that you talk with?
The climatologist I speak to, the fellow I speak to down is Dan Kahan down in Scripps Institute. He told me he did not see this as a climate warming event. He said that, and he was telling me you can't really look at certain events and say, that's climate warming. He said that, you know, there's so much noise, so much variability in the system that, you know, certainly there may be some sort of influence going on that we're going to be able to tease out later on. But, you know, I mean, it's an overall effect over decades that you're looking at, not just one winter.
The other thing that a lot of people are very concerned with this year, dealing with the environment and the lack of snowfall and precipitation throughout the mountains and foothills, is the possibility of a severe wildfire season. Cal Fire already has ramped up their crews very early. In January, we saw a very rare event, a wildfire burning in the Golden Trout Wilderness up above Porterville. What are you hearing from your sources as far as the possibility of this being a bad wildfire season? Is it maybe there isn't as much vegetation this year? So maybe could that be? Sometimes we hear when it's a really wet year, it's going to be a bad wildfire season as well. So what are your thoughts on that?
I think there are varying degrees of fire seasons. I think maybe the grasslands are probably not as thick and deep and maybe not as prone in the past, but they just might be because it's very dry. But at the same time, there's a lot of vegetation in the Sierra. The Sierra, it was blown dry this winter. There were startling pictures of bare ground at 10,000 feet in January, things I have never personally seen before. And if we get something going like that rim fire last August, look out. This could be the year that something really, really bad happens.
We certainly hope that's not the case. Again, we've been talking with Mark Grassi. He is the award-winning environmental reporter for the Fresno Bee and one of the state's finest in covering issues about water and the environment. He joins us today to talk about his recent reporting about El Nino and its potential impact on next year's water season. Mark Grassi, again, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, sir.
We'll be back in just a moment on Valley Edition and talk with officials at Fresno's Chaffee Zoo. Some great news with the birth of those four tiger cubs, the rare Malayan tigers, but also some sad news as their father, Paca, died yesterday. We'll talk to zoo officials about how people can see the tiger cubs and what their survival means for the future of the Malayan tiger species. That's coming up next on Valley Edition. Listening to Valley Edition. Fresno's Chaffee Zoo is one of the gems of the San Joaquin Valley. The zoo recently began construction of a major expansion funded by the Measure Z sales tax. And while that's generating a lot of attention, it pales in comparison with the buzz received by the four Malayan tiger cubs that were born at the zoo earlier this year. Those rare baby tigers can now be seen at the zoo daily. Here to tell us more is Lynn Myers. She is the assistant curator at the Chaffee Zoo. Lynn, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
These tiger cubs, it seems like they were just born a few weeks ago, and now they are the talk of the town, running all about their enclosure.
They are. You know, they grow so quickly. They were born on January 5th, so just recently they hit their three-month mark, and they gain about 2 to 3 pounds a week, and so they're pushing 25 pounds now. And they're jumping, and they're running, and they're active, and they're just nonstop. So it's great to see them right now while they're really active.
This is a big thing, not only because people love baby animals, but this is a big thing for this species as well. This is an endangered species, as I understand it. There's around 500 of these in the wild. How did we come to have these tiger cubs in Fresno? Is this a breeding program?
It is a breeding program. You know, at one time we had 9 types of tigers living in the wild. Today, unfortunately, we only have 6 left, Malayan being one of them. And they hope that on a good day there may be 500 still left out in the wild. So those are one of the species that we are targeting to try to get those numbers up in captivity. So there is a Malayan breeding program in the United States, only one in the world, and there are about 60 cats in that breeding program. And our 4 cubs made that number rise to almost 60 cats. So it's pretty exciting and a really important birth because every single individual is really important for that genetic possibility in the future.
Now, these are not just nameless tiger cubs. They have names. How did they get their names and what are they?
These tiger cubs were actually named by a lot of people. What we did was anybody who worked at the zoo, it didn't matter which department, everybody got to put in their choices of names. And we had a couple stipulations in that they needed to be Malayan or Indonesian. They needed to have a meaning behind them, and they needed to be something that we could say and understand. And so we actually got over 100 names put into the arena for consideration. And then my staff, who work with the tigers every day, they actually kind of dwindled it down to names that were easy to sound, easy to say, easy for the tigers to understand, just a few syllables long. And then we actually went on Facebook and had people vote.
So what are those names and what do they mean?
We had 4 names that we ended up choosing. We have Chinta, which means love. And you can always tell Chinta because on Chinta's tail, he has a V pattern on his tail. All tiger stripes are unique to them. So their tails is how we told them apart. Chinta has a V. Barani means brave. And Barani has a dot on his tail. Aria means warrior, has a line on her tail. And the Mbatari, she's the largest of the cubs, and her name means goddess, and she has a horseshoe on her tail.
Do they all have their own traits at this point?
They do. Aria, we always think Aria has a really sweet personality, but she's kind of mischievous in the same way, and she reminds us a lot of her mom because her mom is pretty active. Her mom's a little spitfire, and we think Aria is going to follow in that. We could be totally wrong. And then it's funny because Barani means brave, and he isn't the bravest, and he's actually the whiniest one. In fact, he whines all the time, and his mom's always going back and picking him up because he can't figure something out, or he just gives up, and he just sits there and whines, and she has to go over and carry him to the place she wants him. So if we ever hear a cub yelling, it's always Barani. So
what has the response been like?
It's been overwhelming. You know, what we have done differently with the cubs that we haven't done with any other births is we had a camera on mom before she even birthed. So we have all the birthing on tape. And then we had a monitor out in the front so our guest could watch those cubs with mom from day one all the way to the point of where they came out. And they came out at about 8 weeks of age. We put them out in the exhibit. So we had people coming to the zoo just to watch the video. And to be able to be a part of that is something that we've never done before. So people got to follow them from day one. So expectations were really high by 8 weeks of age. They were pretty excited.
We were talking about the public expectation and the great interest this has received. Where are they in terms of their development? What is the development process for a tiger cub, for a Malayan tiger cub like?
You know, they turn into tigers so quickly. They really do. We did a bit of handling with them. Mom was really gracious about being able to shift away from them so we could go in and get weights on them and handle them and check them and make sure they were doing well. And they did pretty well for a few weeks, but they turn into tigers right before your eye. And when they don't like what you're doing, they're not short in letting you know that. They can bark at you. They'll try to bite you. They try to scratch. And they're also doing that to one another because it's just great fun to do that to one another also. And mom's really happy she had four because four can keep themselves occupied. It's hard on a mom when you only have one or two cubs because they tend to jump on her and chew on her and bite her. But with four, there's always someone to play with.
Now, cats of any size, any species, like to sleep a lot.
They do sleep a lot, yes.
Are these cats out on display? Or are they visible to the public?
We bring the cubs out. Mom goes out early in the morning because she does like her time away from the cubs. So she goes out pretty early in the morning. And then usually by 10 or 11 o'clock, we have the cubs going out to join her on exhibit. And she's really excited to see them and does some nursing. But yeah, they're out. The cubs are pretty much out from 11 to close. And right now that's 6 p.m. at our zoo.
When do they reach maturity? We're talking about how they become tigers so quickly.
Tigers are full size at 3 to 4 years, but they can be of breeding age by about 2.5. So 2.5, you're looking at a pretty good sized cat. As soon as they're on meat diets, which they have started already, they start gaining about 10 to 12 pounds a month.
Wow.
So they grow really fast.
What is their future like? How long will they be in Fresno?
Our estimate is that they'll be with us for about 1.5 to 2 years of age. And at that time, just like they would out in the wild, they'll break away from mom. They actually start even get stop. They don't get as long as well because they don't like to share resources. That's not of their nature to share resources. So at about that age in the wild, they'd go off on their own and claim territories for themselves. And here at the zoo, they'll go off to other zoos and become part of the breeding program at that time.
Now, we did have a bit of sad news earlier this week in the father of these tiger cubs, a longtime favorite of many here in Fresno at the Chaffee Zoo, Paca, was euthanized. Tell me about him and the situation there. We see the whole life cycle here before us. Tell me about Paca.
You know, Paca was a really special individual. He was a really easygoing tiger. Staff really enjoyed working with him because he was just – seemed to be very comfortable in their presence. He came to us a couple years ago from San Diego, and he really took to us right away. I think he had a great life in San Diego because people were very pleasing and very comfortable to him, including our guests. He would vocalize a lot when he was at an exhibit. Sometimes people were not sure what the vocalization meant, but basically he's claiming his territory when he's vocalizing. He's letting other tigers know, this is my spot. I'm not going to share it and don't come into it. So he's really active. He trained well. It was just a real honor to be in his presence. And any of us that worked with him, it was definitely something that we enjoyed and felt very lucky to be a part of his life.
If you just join us on Valley Edition today, we are talking with Lynn Myers. She is the assistant curator of Fresno's Chaffee Zoo. Of course, a lot of people across the valley are talking about the four Malayan tiger cubs, which were born at the zoo earlier this year. They are certainly quite photogenic, shall we say, for folks who have seen their photos. And you can see some online at kvpr.org. But I want to talk beyond these cubs now, because there's a lot of other things at the zoo. I understand there's also some other young animals at the zoo.
Yeah, actually, we have kind of babies born throughout the year. But currently, we have a small colobus who, although she's got her adult coloring in, she is a colobus monkey, and she is jumping everywhere in the exhibit. We have some new wolves that just recently came in. They're just finishing up their quarantine, and we hope that they have bred during that quarantine period, and they should be viewable to the public within the next 2 weeks. So those are great to see. We've also groundbroken for our brand-new African exhibit. So that's pretty exciting because that's going to double the size of Fresno Chaffee Zoo. And all of this was made possible simply by the tax initiative that Fresno County passed several years ago that enabled us to not only build our sea lion exhibit, which has now been open for almost 2 years, it's also helping us to build this brand new African exhibit that's just going to be outstanding. We're really excited. We're going to have a big herd of giraffes. We're bringing in lions. We're bringing in cheetahs, meerkats. We're going to have a lizard exhibit, vultures, a new lodge for everybody to eat and dine with the animals. It's going to be pretty crazy and pretty fun.
The Sea Lion Cove exhibit is really stellar, and it's a great example of the type of new improvements that we're seeing at the zoo. What's the timeline like for the African exhibit, and where are we in that?
We might have to open it up because we're building so many things at once in Africa. It's not just one exhibit. It's a handful of exhibits. So some may open earlier than others, but we are hoping that we will get the ball rolling as it is now and be opening those exhibits in the fall of 2015.
With the increased interest from things like the tiger cubs, do you see attendance at the zoo up? Do you see more school kids coming through or families?
It's really up. That's exciting up. You know, every weekend we seem to have more and more people. It's pretty crazy. We have, you know, I remember years ago, I've been there for 15 years, and I remember really quiet weekends and weekdays in years past, and now our weekends, really quite a few people coming out, even our weekdays. Now it's spring, so we have a lot of school kids coming. They always kind of come with the buses in the morning in the springtime. It's a happening place in Fresno, that's for sure.
Going back to the tiger cubs, is there anything about them or this their development kind of behind the scenes that you could share that maybe most people don't know about these cubs and or maybe their mother or just the whole process?
I think one interesting fact is that both Paca and Mek are male and female. They actually are cats that came from the wild, and that is pretty unusual. Paca and Mek were living in Malaysia, and they were problem cats. They got too close. Mek especially got too close to human civilization, and generally those cats are destroyed. During the time when they got in trouble and they came in with humans, they were actually captured, and the government allowed 6 cats to leave Malaysia and come into the breeding program in the United States. And that's pretty rare because this is such a small breeding program. Every single individual is really important. And you can't make a breeding program out of just a couple pairs because genetically everybody's going to end up being related. So it was outstanding that Malaysia was actually able to allow those cats to leave because they are founder populations to this breeding program. And without them, I don't know that our breeding program would have had a chance. So both of them, they are really important. Paca helped to sire 14 cubs in his lifetime, and that's just huge. His contribution to Malayan tigers in captivity and the future of a genetic population in captivity is just – it's remarkable.
It's an incredible story, and he certainly will be missed by many in Fresno, but his bloodline will live on, and we're so excited to see these tiger cubs here at Fresno's Chaffee Zoo. Again, our guest today has been Lynn Myers. She is the assistant curator for the zoo, and the cubs are visible to the public?
They are. We tend to get them out. We can absolutely say on most days, weather permitting, they will be out from 11 to 5, and sometimes it's a little earlier and sometimes it's a little later than that. But 11 to 5 are good hours.
Great. Well, we look forward to seeing them. Lynn, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having us.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. While the nation has finally recovered most of the private sector jobs lost in the Great Recession, and the stock market has reached all-time highs, if you ask many average people, the economic downturn that began in 2008 doesn't seem all that far away. The effects linger to this day. But in this edition of FM89's commentary series, The Moral Is, Fresno State business law professor Ida Jones says that a 5-year statute of limitations for those most responsible for the meltdown is a serious problem.
Time's running out. It's more than 5 years after the most severe economic downturn since the Great Depression cost the U.S. economy more than $22 trillion and homeowners nearly $9.1 billion in lost wealth. That's according to the Government Accountability Office's estimates. Yet not one CEO of the major financial institution that caused the crisis has spent a day in jail. Now, the good news is that the taxpayers have recovered nearly 96% of the Troubled Assets Relief Program taxpayer bailout. Congress created TARP to help solve part of the financial crisis, and the economy is slowly recovering. That's all good. The bad news is, according to federal judge Rakoff, not a single high-level executive has been successfully prosecuted, and given the fact that most of the relevant criminal provisions are governed by a 5-year statute of limitations, it appears likely that none will be. So why is that bad news? It's bad news because those whose conduct caused the crisis aren't being held responsible. Nearly everyone agrees that the financial crisis was created through a combination of risky investments, fraudulent reporting to investors, and greedy financiers manipulating the system to maximize their profits at all costs. And at least some of that conduct involved investments that were so speculative as to be criminally fraudulent. Yet not one high-level executive has been held accountable. Instead, taxpayers have had to rely on a system of government oversight and recovery of taxpayer bailout funds. And some of those same taxpayers bore the brunt. They lost their homes. So why is it that mortgage brokers and other relatively small fish were the only ones criminally prosecuted and CEOs weren't? Why did government fail to prosecute any top officials when in the past government did prosecute those like Charles Keating Jr., a central figure in the savings and loan crisis of the 1980s? This time, according to the U.S. Attorney General, CEOs weren't prosecuted because the Attorney General was concerned it might cause another financial collapse. That means that government decided that it would prefer to file civil suits against the companies, but not file criminal charges against the individuals who led those companies and whose conduct caused the problem in the first place. And now the bell has tolled for society, and the CEOs have gotten away with financial murder. For The Moral Is, this is Ida Jones.
The Moral Is a production of Valley Public Radio and the Bonner Center for Character Education at California State University, Fresno. You can find more commentaries on our website at kvpr.org. April is National Child Abuse Prevention Month, and this year, a new traveling exhibit is in Fresno that hopes to raise awareness of this issue by going beyond the headlines and statistics to understand the plight of children plagued by abuse. It's currently underway at Central High School's district office in Fresno, now through May 4th. It's called the LISA Project, and joining us now, we have Director Gene Harden on the phone with us. Gene, welcome to Valley Edition.
Thank you very much, Joe. Appreciate it.
Gene, how did this project start out? You are throughout California bringing this exhibit to audiences statewide. Where did it come from?
Well, basically it came from little old Stockton. We're based out of Stockton at the Child Abuse Prevention Council there. My wife has been the executive director of our Child Abuse Prevention Council for about the last 10 years, but this came about in 2010. We had talked for a long time about how you raise awareness and educate people, because really in this world, it seems that that is the way we get things changed and accomplished, is by, you know, getting people to talk about it. But child abuse isn't something that people want to readily talk about because a lot of guilt and shame is associated with it, and that's very understandable. We were at an exhibit in San Francisco, just completely unrelated, but we were carrying some audio devices with us, and it kind of tipped an idea for me. When we left the exhibit, I looked at my wife and I said, why couldn't we do this for child abuse? In other words, take a child by the hand, let them tell you their story, figuratively. And she thought that was a pretty good idea, and so we embarked on the journey called the LISA Project and came up with this idea of an interactive exhibit.
Is there a LISA behind the name?
Yes, I'm glad you asked. Yes, the very first room that you encounter inside the exhibit is, first of all, let me explain. You get an iPod, and it's kind of a self-guided tour. You press play, and a series of chimes and dings allow you to go from room to room. But the very first room that you encounter is a 911 call made by a little girl by the name of Lisa when she was about 6 years old. And you hear part of her story in that room, and then we wrap up her story in the very end after you've heard from some other kids.
And how does the rest of the exhibit play out?
Well, the exhibit is built like rooms inside of a house, where each room tells a different story. You hear from basically a different child's story. We cover all types of abuse, you know, from domestic violence to neglect, verbal and emotional abuse, sexual abuse, and of course physical abuse. Touching on each one of those and crossing, racial and socioeconomic barriers as well. To just help people understand that it has nothing to do with somebody being poor or of a certain race or anything like that. Abuse, child abuse happens to everyone.
You mentioned that child abuse is something that people don't like to talk about so often, and there's many reasons for that. Was it difficult to gather these stories? How did you go about gathering these stories?
So at our center, and sadly in every community, including, Fresno, abuse happens all the time. So unfortunately, we're not at a loss for stories. At our center, we have social workers on staff, and so we had case files of stories, which is what we pulled to use. So all the stories that you hear are true. We've changed names and so on to, protect the privacy of people.
How has the exhibit been received statewide?
Very well. We've had the fortune of being basically running the exhibit from, basically as far north as Sacramento and then down to Riverside County. Anytime we take the exhibit to a community, it's usually there for about a month. And within that month, we've seen anywhere between, roughly 1,500 to 1,800 people, upwards of over 5,000 people go through it in a month. And it's received very well with a number of emotions and thoughts as people come out.
If you just joined us today, we're talking with Gene Hardin. He is the director of the LISA Project, a traveling exhibit that's currently at the Central High School District or Central Unified District office on Gettysburg Avenue in Fresno. It's an event that's sponsored by First Five of Fresno County, the Fresno County Office of Education, Central Unified School District, and Community Regional Medical Center. Who do you hope will see this exhibit? Who is the audience?
So the audience, marketing people hate this, but the audience is really everyone. The idea behind this, Joe, is that we have the ability to reach out to everyday people to say, there might be a time, this isn't making you aware of bad parenting. We've all seen the parent in Target, dragging their kid across the parking lot or, yelling or something. Unfortunately, there's no law against bad parenting. We're talking about clear, compelling evidence of child abuse. And chances are, we feel that there are times when you, as just Joe average citizen, no pun intended there, that you've possibly heard something from a neighbor or seen something that kind of made the hair on the back of your neck stand up. And it's those times that we're trying to get people to say, all right, now what do I do with that information? And here's some resources. So it's very important. Not only do we raise your awareness inside the exhibit and educate you a little bit, but also give you a point of contact within your own community. So what you find at the end of the exhibit are tables full of resources within the Fresno community for both things, for people who want to help, and so there's volunteer opportunities, and for people who need help. We make sure we get them connected to those resources. So we're really trying to reach out to just everyday people. And just to elaborate on that a little bit more, because we believe that, yes, there are first responders, and yes, there are doctors and nurses and teachers whose job it is as mandated reporters to see these things and to report these things. But we also believe it's everybody's job to help protect the children in our societies.
I understand you have a website with some resources and other information on that. What can people do to find information online?
Absolutely. Very simply, thelisaproject.org. And that'll tell you a lot about, what's going on in Fresno and around the state with the exhibit itself. Certainly, first5fresno.org, that's with the number 5 in there, and lots of great resources from them as well.
Again, we've been talking with Gene Hardin. He is the director of the LISA Project. It's a traveling exhibit that's currently in Fresno this month at the Central Unified District office. And the exhibit provides firsthand accounts of the impact of child abuse and raises awareness of this issue during National Child Abuse Awareness Month. Again, Gene, thank you so much for joining us today on Valley Edition.
Well, thank you, Joe. We really appreciate you having us on.
This is Valley Edition.
The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now.
Your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us Here and Now.
Listen Monday through Thursday from 11 to 1 p.m. on Valley Public Radio.
Listening to Valley Edition. Fresno's William Saroyan Theater is getting wicked, literally. The Broadway show is currently on a North American tour with a 12-day stop in Fresno. The production features 15 performances now through April 13th. It's both an amazing musical theater experience and an impressive technical production, one that hopes to draw as many as 34,000 fans over the next few days to the Saroyan Theater. Joining us now in the studio is one of the members of the cast of the production, Matt Shingledecker. Matt, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, tell us about your role.
I play Fiero. He is the love interest to the two witches, Glinda the Good and the Wicked Witch of the West. And there's a nice little love triangle going on between the three of us. And that's sort of my pivotal role, being sort of a divider between the two ladies, helping them come together even at certain points. And that's sort of that's my role.
Do you ever have to, like, pinch yourself and say, I'm actually in this production playing this role? I mean, what was your first experience with Wicked as an audience member? It's such a huge, such a famous production.
Actually, my first experience was actually rather unique. I was at the Tony Awards the year that Wicked was up for all the Tonys, and they actually won costume design, best costume design. Fantastic costumes when you see the show there. They're amazing. And I got to see that was the only Tony performance I had ever been to live, and that was an incredible experience, and that was my first taste of Wicked. And the first time I saw it, I was actually studying abroad in London, doing some stuff with my university, Elon University, and some stuff with Royal College of Music, studying voice there. And I saw Wicked there, which is a really amazing experience because their theater is lit up completely green in some sections. It's really cool what they've done with that theater, and each production and each different place has its own unique nuances.
So you've been with this current production that's been on tour for the last 5 years. You've been with it for how long now?
9 weeks.
9 weeks. What is that like, immersing yourself in this role, going to all these different cities, and you're working with some people who have been with the production a long time, some people who are fresh for this Fresno performance? What is that dynamic like of this constantly changing cast?
Well, it helps keep it fresh. You know, our main goal is to deliver a completely fresh new production every single night, and that's what we strive for. And you know, we're open to making our own choices in the moment and doing a lot of fresh things. And so if you see the show from one night to the next, it might be completely different. And so of course, every city that we go to, every new person that joins the cast, all the turnaround, that all contributes to that staying fresh and never getting stale.
What do you think it is about Wicked that you could credit its great popularity to and its devoted fans? There are some very passionate Wicked fans. What do you think it is about this production and this play that is so unique?
I think it's everything. I mean, let's start with the music. I mean, the music is a lot of hit songs from that. That kind of culture sort of died away for a while, where musical numbers would become pop hits and stuff like that. And I remember when Wicked first came out, they were playing some of the soundtrack on when you would go to movie theaters and before a movie, because they're connected to Universal. And I think sort of this changing appeal, going back to that musicals, movies, media all can sort of work together, that's definitely one piece. And what accomplishes that is also the cinematic directing from Joe Mantello. there's only one blackout in the entire piece besides the end of Act One and Act Two. Every scene folds in and out of each other. I definitely think that's a unique aspect. That, the music, the technical elements, the costumes, and the story. It's familiar, but completely fresh. I mean, it's another take on the witches from another point of view. And I think just the aspect of looking at any story from another side is both refreshing and important. And I think doing that makes people think when they leave the theater.
Again, if you just joined us on Valley Edition today, our guest is Matt Shingledecker. He plays Fiero in the current Broadway tour of the musical Wicked, which is at the Soroyan Theater now through April 13th. Walk us through what's it like for the cast being in a city. You're setting up in a new theater. You're here for 2 weeks, essentially. You've got new people coming in, people going. What's it like behind the scenes for folks like yourself?
Behind the scenes, you know, between cities, we get a couple days off, one day to travel, one day to have off, and that also facilitates the show moving from one place to the other. And I think we have about 12 huge trucks that pack the show. The entire stage is all ours that we put on top of whatever stage of the venue we're in. So they work like crazy. I think they hire an extra 100 locals in every city to move the show out, to move it in. A lot of the orchestra is always local. A lot of our dressers, a lot of crew members. And that leads to an amazing dynamic. And for us, you know, we sort of come in, we get into our hotel or whatever apartment we've sort of settled down in, try to settle but not settle too much because we got to leave soon. And, you know, during our free time, try to take advantage of each city. You know, it's in a lot of ways, even though we don't have a lot of time, it's a paid vacation. And we get to see the country, which is amazing. And we're about to go on a Canadian stint for a while. After Fresno, it's Boise, Spokane, and then Vancouver. And Vancouver through Toronto is about 6 months long. And we get some incredibly long stops there. 5 weeks in Vancouver, 9 weeks in Toronto.
Not bad places to be stuck for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and Fresno either. You know, my dad's actually from Fresno.
Oh, really?
And he gets in tomorrow, which will be rather exciting. And he hasn't been back in decades, so he's going to try to see if we can find his old house. And
wow.
I think we're going to check out Yosemite. And this is my first time in Fresno and having a blast. The first week is always really busy because we do have 2 days off. We have 8 shows in 5 days instead of 8 shows in 6 days. And so between sort of sound checking the city and getting in and all that good stuff, we basically have 2 shows every single day. And today I'm doing, you know, this interview with you and all that good stuff. And so it's pretty busy. So we, you know, we just have to take advantage of the little bit of time we have to eat, sleep and see some sights and then go back to doing the show for you guys.
Is this something you always wanted to do, life on the road in a touring production? What was your did you ever imagine you'd be doing this sort of thing?
You know, my first big project, I would say, was Spring Awakening on Broadway. And then 4 months later, I went on the tour, and I did that for almost 2 years. So, you know, I toured there. And to tour, you know, right out of college is a totally different experience than touring, you know, a few years later, like now. And it's nice to sort of get to do it over again with a new mentality.
How is it different?
Well, I'm older and I'm smarter and I'm definitely not as idiot child as I was right out of college. But I'm sure everybody thinks of that, like, you know, themselves 5 years before now. We always think we know more and we really probably know less, but who knows? Yeah, it's just different. You know, I'm more of an adult, I guess. That's the best way to describe it. And it's nice to have done it before. It felt like that was, in a lot of ways, a good practice. And now I get to do it again. And I know all the tricks that I had developed then. And I can now develop new tricks. And I just feel like I'm, you know, starting a little ahead of the game instead of just being thrown into this scenario when you're sort of thrown around the country. And it's a nice, you know, it's a nice break. I really feel like I've been traveling for ever, you know, since I left home, really, because I went to college and I studied abroad in London, and then I went to New York to do Spring Awakening, and then I went on the road for 2 years, and I went to LA for a little bit, and then I came back to New York to do another show, and now I'm back on the road doing Wicked, and I feel like sort of a hotel room is, in a weird way, my home. I'd like to change that one day and have a real home. But for now, you know, this is sort of the perfect time to be doing that.
You were mentioning how some of the leads in this show are new for Fresno. What is that dynamic like right there, having new folks in the mix? And do you have a lot of rehearsal time, or is the two performances a day rehearsal enough?
You know, honestly, we don't. Coming into the show, you only rehearse and basically watch the show. But once you're in the show, there's only a limited time that you really can. And so we only get, I want to say I had about 8 hours with the new girls, really, all in all. You know, maybe 10 all in all before they did their very first show. And, you know, they're thrown in. But that energy and that excitement and that adrenaline is incredible. And to have the opportunity to build a show, you know, 9 weeks ago with people who have been doing it forever and getting comfortable and coming in and then getting to build an entirely new show with these new girls is fantastic. And they're amazing. It's great to, you know, we're very lucky to have gone from an incredible cast to a completely different but equally incredible cast. And that's really nice, and they're such sweet people, and that makes a big difference on the road, you know, because you're living with these people, you're eating with them, you're working with them, and the fact that they're all so great is a really wonderful treat.
Well, we're certainly looking forward to the production here in Fresno. Now through April 13th, 15 performances in all. It's the North American tour of Wicked, returning to Fresno's William Saroyan Theater. Again, our guest today on Valley Edition has been Matt Shingledecker. He plays the role of Fierro. Matt, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Well, that's all for this week's Valley Edition. We hope you enjoyed our program. You can send us your thoughts. Email us, talk@kvpr.org, or go online to Twitter and tweet us a comment, @KVPR. You can also find us on Facebook and on Instagram, Valley Public Radio. We're online, and we'd love to hear from you. For producer Ezra David Romero, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.